Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. This is your host, Eric Davis, calling this week from my home state of California. It's very nice to be back for a little bit here. It's in many ways ground zero for the modern cultures of consciousness, which we explore here on the show. One of the most interesting publishing events that has occurred over the last couple of years, in my opinion, was the release of Carl Jung's big, very heavy, rather expensive, and incredibly amazing and curious book, The Red Book, Liber Novus. And one of the things that was interesting about it is not just that this sort of secret text of one of the 20th century's most important and controversial psychologists and thinkers finally was available, but what a huge success it was, very surprising to pretty much everyone involved. And even the way that a lot of us sort of first heard about the publication was already an indication that things were going to be a little different when the New York Times Magazine, I think her name is Sarah Corbett, wrote a piece about the Red Book before it came out. And in general, the New York Times is not the kind of place that you're going to find very kind things said about Carl Jung and Jungian thought and the archetypes, et cetera, like a lot of deeply secular, committedly secular zones in the intellectual universe. Carl Jung tends to be seen as sort of a little loopy, a little fuzzy, a little new age, and even a little dangerous. But this was a very positive article that I think got a lot of people excited that would not otherwise be. And many, many, many people bought the book. I don't know what the numbers are exactly, but it went into a second printing pretty quickly. And all of that was just very interesting to me. I mean, setting aside the issue of what was actually in the book, which we're going to be able to talk about this hour with our guest, Dr. Stefan Hohler, was just the fact that people were so interested, and it seemed to indicate something about a phase we're at with recognizing the validity of Jung's biography, his ideas, his experiences, and also I think something about the need for contemporary mysteries. The esoteric quality of the book, the fact that it came out of these very profound and in some ways very disturbing and not particularly rational experiences on his part and that were very deeply tied to his experiences resonate with something in people, the sense that there is a deeper level of our own experiencing of our own lives that has meaning, that drives us, and in many ways drives us more than what other people would see on the surface. So there was something about the mystery there, and the sense that something was being revealed that was both ancient and also contemporary in some way. You know, this wasn't the work of some hermetic, alchemist from the 16th century, but from a 20th century person who considered himself in many ways a scientist, even though most people would not think of him as that today. So in any case, I'm very glad that we have our guest today to help us unpack some of the mysteries of the Red Book. But before I bring Dr. Hohler on, I'd like to, of course, introduce Expanding Mind's own co-host, Maja Daou. How you doing, Maja?
Good. How are you, Eric?
Pretty good. I know you're actually extra excited about this week's episode.
I am. It's true.
You are a red book groupie, are you not?
I am. And you know, one of the things I think about what you were saying, Eric, in regards to like the popularity of the Red Book and how it is this bridge between ancientness and contemporariness, that was kind of like Carl Jung's deal, was to tie all this into a collective consciousness that is timeless and spaceless. And I think, you know, a part of a big way it was done is the pictures in there. Like, even for folks that can't get that into, you know, some of the big psychological terminology and all of the scholarliness, you can just look at the book as an object, at these dreamy pictures. And that's where I think most people connect to it. And what Jung discovered was that there is an underlying dream theme that we're all experiencing. And so you don't even have to get into all of the kind of mumbo jumbo to be able to find a connection to this book. And I think that's like probably the most powerful thing about it.
Yeah, that's a wonderful point, because the images are remarkable. Well, with that, I'd like to bring on our guest, Dr. Stefan Holler. Dr. Holler, thank you for joining us today.
Hello there, Mr. Davis. I'm very happy to be on your show, and thank you very much for having me.
Wonderful. Well, I mean, in addition to being a scholar of Jungian psychology and Gnosticism, you're the regionary bishop of the Ecclesia Gnostica, an actual Gnostic church, and you've been doing that for quite a while there in Los Angeles.
For about 50 years. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and so I guess one place I'd like to start is just how your interest in Jung has been part of your career in Gnostic spirituality, like as part of your work as a Gnostic spiritual leader.
Yes, well, of course, I think that there is really a close connection between the two, and as far as my personal interest is concerned, I've had a vital, almost all-consuming interest in the Gnostic tradition ever since my teens, and then I encountered some of the writings of C.G. Jung when I was still back going to school in Austria, including a very rare little book of his called The Seven Sermons to the Dead, which is actually a part of the Red Book, but we didn't know that at that time. The only portion of the Red Book material that he had ever allowed to be published, although it was published privately. And primarily on the basis of that material, I became convinced that really Jung was a kindred spirit, that he was a modern Gnostic, and that he and his work had to be definitely included in my self-declared curriculum, as it were, of Gnostic studies. And I kept that up throughout my increasingly long life.
Well, can you just tell me a little bit about what would make a modern Gnostic? I mean, people use the term very loosely. You know, Thomas Pynchon is Gnostic, and Philip K. Dick is Gnostic, and William and Burroughs. I mean, it's often used because it has this dimension of personal illumination associated with it. It has a dimension of kind of controversy or heresy, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a widely used and abused term. For you, what makes someone, an authentic modern Gnostic, someone like Jung or others?
Well, I would say that certainly one requirement, or at least a very useful commodity in being a Gnostic, is to be familiar with the Gnostic matrix of thought as a tradition. We have available to us now a rather large number of original Gnostic scriptures, which were actually discovered pretty late in history, in the late 1940s, but which are now generally available and have been commented on a great deal, the so-called Nag Hammadi Library, in addition to a few other scriptures. And so we have a fairly good knowledge, if we wish to avail ourselves of it, of the actual tradition that came to be called Gnostic, and which in various ways is still with us. Now, of course, there is always a possibility of using these terms in a very loose, in a very latitudinarian fashion, and that has its own merit. But I think it's really much more important to be aware of the the nature of the Gnostic tradition itself, and that requires a certain amount of study and reading and so forth.
Well, one way to tie it in is just with the question of Jung is the role of experience, is that even though, of course, there are mystical experiences and transcendent experiences that are part of Catholicism, that are part of Protestantism even, and of course all the world traditions have their own forms of it, there's a particular emphasis on direct experience or on a direct unfolding or download, you might even say, using contemporary terms, in the Gnostic tradition. And this seems to be related with Jung to the fact that the core or the root of the Red Book is not just a concept or even a set of dreams, but really an extraordinary event in his life or series of events. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that, the role of experience, even sometimes frightening and overwhelming experiences in the Gnostic exploration, almost the other side. If one side is the study and the understanding of this matrix of information, which we have so much of today, there's also a side that really, you know, puts your own experience on the line.
Yes, of course, the study of Gnostic scriptures, at best, or what it can do is point toward the nature and the necessity for Gnostic experience, and also perhaps often presents a framework, a kind of a worldview, a psycho-cosmology within which one's experience can find its place and can become understood. So that is certainly true. Well, what we need to keep in mind is that the very core of the Gnostic tradition is based on the Greek term gnosis, has to do with a liberating knowledge. So it is not just knowledge that informs. It is knowledge that has a profound, what nowadays we would call probably psychological effect on the human personality, and that liberates the human personality from various forms of confinement and bondage, both physical and psychological, which afflicts us here on Earth. So while many religions, of course, will have their own statements about what saves or redeems or liberates, to the Christians it is belief in Jesus Christ, to the Buddhists it is enlightenment, to the Muslims it is submission to the will of Allah, and so forth, to the Gnostics. It is the acquisition of a certain kind of inner knowing, which by its very nature liberates or redeems. And that's a very important issue. Now, as to C.G. Jung, there is a great deal of evidence, and that has been known all along. We didn't have to wait for the Red Book for that. That Jung was, from his youth on, vitally interested in the Gnostic tradition. That was really his primary interest as far as early spiritual philosophies were concerned. The secondary ones being Hermeticism, which is very closely related to that Neoplatonism, and later on in his life, Kabbalah. And of course he was interested in these disciplines not primarily from an intellectual point of view, from a conceptual point of view, but because he felt that these traditions were based on the kind of liberating spiritual experience which he himself was seeking, and which at a certain point, right at the time when the Red Book was written by him, he apparently received in considerable measure.
Well, and I'd like to talk about that experience a little, because many really refer to the Red Book as a chronicalization of Jung's kind of descent into madness. And there is this tentative danger involved in those extreme spiritual experiences. And, you know, part of it, and even Jung kind of cautioned against going to great depths here, although it's necessary. It's that kind of shamanic death, really, that one experiences to kind of get into that noumenosity. What do you think, that it was a kind of descent into madness, or how would you describe what Jung kind of went through with that experience?
To the extent that, let's say, many psychotic, many deranged people do descend into the unconscious, as depth psychology calls it, and then have a hard time getting back from it, or maybe never come back from it at all, remain in a deranged condition, to that extent that there is a minor similarity. But of course this issue has come up, you know, in all along since the publication of the Red Book and all the various meetings that were held, it has come up. And Dr. Sunu Shandasani, who is the general editor of the work, and without whom the Red Book would have never really seen the light of day, absolutely marvelous gentleman. He lives in England. Dr. Shandasani was asked this at the opening event of the exhibit here in Los Angeles. And the opening event was held at UCLA. The exhibit was held at the Armand Hammer Museum. And Dr. Shandasani said that the difference is that Jung, while partaking of these highly unusual visionary experiences, kept a perfectly normal professional and family schedule. He did all of his writing at night. He saw patients in the daytime. He already had a wife and several children. He attended to them. He attended to social obligations. So there was no kind of disruption of his ability and willingness to deal with the with the world and with his worldly responsibilities. And that does not happen with people who are crazy.
Right.
You know, the very hallmark of a psychosis is that there is an inability to relate to the external world, because one's consciousness has fallen into the internal world to such a great extent. So I don't think that we need to be concerned that this was a madness. What we can say is, yes, he experienced unusual states of consciousness on a regular basis for several years, maybe with some little interruptions here and there, and that he kept a careful record of these experiences, wrote them down in little notebooks, some of which were shown at the Red Book exhibit, the so-called black books, because they were sort of like school notebooks in a black cover, and then later on he edited and revised to some degree these original manuscripts, and then in a beautiful medieval looking calligraphy entered them into a large book, first in parchment, but later on just a good quality of paper, and this was in a huge red leather binding, and that became the Red Book. So basically that's what he did. And then he was subject to visions, but on an intermittent and rare basis later on in his life. This intense visionary period went from about 1913 until the end of 1916. But he made occasional entries into the Red Book throughout the course of his life.
Well, I'm really curious to hear. There's so much, you know. There's so much going on in the Red Book, and obviously we have so much time. Before, you know, asking you about some of the things that you think are most important, or that maybe people are not
picking up on. I'd just like to hear a little bit about your experience of studying it. You know, at some point, you, after decades and decades of study on precisely this kind of material, finally get the book in your hands, and you get to spend, you know, weeks and weeks with it. Talk a little about what that experience was like. Well, what was like for you to open it up?
All right, I'll be happy to. When the Red Book first appeared print, and also in the exhibit of the original book was in New York City, and that was in October, 2 years ago. I was in Budapest, in my native city, when that occurred, so I couldn't go to the opening, so to say, in New York. But as soon as I got back to Los Angeles, I received a copy, and I started working with it, and I immediately went to work with the end in mind and in view to present lectures on the subject. And I did give a series of 13 lectures, each about an hour and 45 minutes long thereafter. And so after an initial overview, I went through the book chapter by chapter and preparing the lectures. And I must tell you that, you know, I have been reading unusual literature ever since I was able to read, and have never read anything like this. I never had any experience of this sort. I usually worked on the Red Book about 3 to 3.5 days a week. Hmm. And during that time, much of the time, I sort of was in an altered state of consciousness myself. I had to stop and get up from the table and walk around a little, because I would be seeing things in the air and all sorts of things of that sort. But I assure you, I didn't become psychotic. I went back and worked some more. But I must say that if one I think truly concentrates on this material and realizes that you are dealing with something truly powerful, and I don't like to use the word, but transformative, then it definitely has a very, very powerful effect on you, and it certainly did with me. So I was in a strange state when I was working with it. It took me almost a couple of days to sort of get out of that mindset. Didn't affect my dreams very much, but certainly almost like being in a waking dream. It's a highly, highly unusual work.
So talk a little bit about what sort of is opened up through that magic. I mean, there's, you know, concepts, there's ideas, it's a record of his experiences, but is there something happening on a kind of larger level, like...
Yes.
A significance that goes outside the record of one, you know, particularly brilliant man.
Yeah, well, one might almost say that the book ostensibly, and he doesn't make any, he doesn't beat around the bush about it. The book really has two purposes. There may have many others, but these are the two that are apparent and that are stated in so many words by Jung himself. And the first of these is that it is a record of his own internal transformation, of a tremendous change that occurred within the man in that period of time. So that's in itself very, very exciting and very valuable, because after all, we are also, let's say, striving for, many of us, and hoping for transformations of perhaps a somewhat similar nature. And this can be an example for us, at least to some degree. And the other is a little more mysterious, and maybe also a little more controversial, and that is that it is also a book of prophecy. And not just prophecy in the sense of a prophet who talks to God, but really prophecy in the sense of forecasting both in general and in sometimes in specific terms certain developments, primarily spiritual developments of the future. And in fact, that is how the book starts. It starts with about four quotations in Latin. The book is written in German. And that helps me a great deal because I was educated in German language school. So, you know, I can go back and forth from the really very excellent translation that they have. I mean, I'm very critical just because I have a fair knowledge of the German language. But I think the translation is very, very good. And so I can go back and forth from the English translation to the German text. And some little passages that he considers to be sort of particularly archetypal are in Latin, and then there are individual words and names in Greek, but it's basically in German. But the book starts with four quotations in Latin from the prophet Isaiah, who of course is, the chief of the four major prophets of the Old Testament. And then one quotation from the Gospel of John. And all of these quotations are the ones that are generally by, Christian Bible people regarded as forecasting the coming of the Messiah. And then he goes on from there, and there's also a very interesting picture right at the very beginning of the book, which in itself is a clue, let us say, to the prophecy. And then after that, sort of mixed into the text where he tells of all of his visions, of transformative visions, his initiations, his encounters with various amazing spiritual figures, and so forth, there are scattered prophetic references about the future. So these are really the two elements, and the prophetic part sort of bothered me a little because I'm very suspicious of predictive prophecies. After all, we all lived through the 60s, when the age of Aquarius was happening and everything was going to change into something absolutely glorious, and of course it did nothing of the sort. And that's kind of the way many of the predictive prophecies of the world work. Namely, they don't work. But with Jung, it is, I think, a little different because he prophesies, shall we say, on a very high and very general spiritual level. Maybe we better stop at that point and allow you to relate yourselves to that.
No, that it's actually a wonderful point you stop because we're at the bottom of the hour, so we're going to take a short break here, but I want to dive right into this questions, and I know Maja's got a bunch as well. So you're listening to Expanding Mind. This is Eric Davis on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hi, I'm Allison Rose Levy. I've been a health journalist for 25 years. I'm currently blogging on the Huffington Post. After more than two decades of studying, talking about, exchanging, and reporting on integrative well-being and collective psychology, I think we're ready to step up to the next level. On Connect the Dots, we're going to reach beyond the merely individual look at health to look at the community, societal, and global level of what we need to address to better our health. Please join me Saturdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I look forward to dialoguing with you.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach, So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
Houston, we have a problem.
Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're talking about Carl Jung's Red Book with Dr. Stefan Haller. And before the break, Dr. Haller was talking about that kind of spiritual legacy that gets left when something like this is presented, and he was talking about his own experience of altered consciousness. And I was just curious, there's some context to this that I kind of found in some of my research. I discovered a fellow named Herbert Stillbearer.
Oh, yes. I know some about him, yeah.
That's right. He worked with Freud kind of almost previous, but also around the same time as Jung. And, in fact, he wrote one of the first books on alchemy and psychology and
That's
then presented
right.
it to Freud.
That's right.
And, in fact, when he split with Freud, he then committed suicide and kind of had a little bit, from what I understand and have read, although there's not much material on it, a sort of similar experience that Jung did during the Red Book, which I just find fascinating that he would have kind of previously had like similar circumstances and then dove into it, and then Jung would kind of do that. And there's that connection to actually just exposure to the Gnostic Hermetic material, you know, not to discount Jung at all, certainly in his own personal experiences of it, but there is this tradition of witnessing this material and then having that affect your consciousness in this spiritual modality, which, you know, as you said, you experience just from reading the material and looking at the pages, that it unlocks or unleashes this spiritual experience. And I was just curious if you personally, I know you experienced that, did you witness any kind of a shift in the collective consciousness when the book came out? Like, did you talk to other people who had similar experiences as
well,
you?
Well, I certainly have talked to a lot of other people. You know, I went to many of the events at the museum where the exhibit was, and there were events, lecture kind of events practically every evening. Some of them I wasn't all that crazy about, but then, you know, a lecturer is usually hypercritical of other lecturers, as you may have noticed yourself.
Yes.
Since you are a one, and a good one at that, if I may say so. In any event, of course I have. And my experience has been in this actually also applies to myself, that those people who have, exposed themselves over a period of time to visionary literature, who are familiar with visionary literature, whether they be the Gnostic writings, whether they be the Hermetic writings, whether they be William Blake or Jacob Böhme or any of these sort of, you know, great mystical seers of history, Louis-Claude de Saint-Martin, people who have been immersed in that kind of literature, they respond in, I think, a very positive and often in a very insightful way to the material in the Red Book, simply because even though it's such a highly unusual book, it is still, we might say, it is within a certain genre. Mm. It is a literary genre of visionary literature. Now, those who are not familiar with that kind of literature and who are primarily, say, of a rationalistic mind, Well, we all have to be rational, otherwise we won't survive in this world, but we don't have to be rationalistic, you know. So those people have a very difficult time with it, and they just don't know what the heck it's all about. Although, I have found that some of those people still tend to respond to the picture, as Mr. Davis mentioned before. And that's an important issue, because there are really two kinds of pictures in the book. There are the pictures which are actually illustrations of the text. And then there are pictures that really have no topical relationship to the text whatsoever, but which are more like, one might say, meditation images, images that are designed to have an effect of the consciousness of the viewer, quite separate from the text of the book. And this has to be kept in mind. And both of these are very valuable.
So well, it isn't.
It's the people who have a sympathy for this sort of material, primarily because of previous exposure, who do best with the material. And with the others, well, it goes this way or that way. And there are a lot of psychologists, including many Jungians, who have a very hard time with the book.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons being that, you know, this is not written in depth psychological jargon. In fact, many of the terms of Jungian, technical terms of Jungian psychology, were not invented yet when this book was written. You have to remember, this was written between 1913 and 1916 during World War I, and Jung had come out of Freudianism, but he hasn't really created his own school and his own terminology yet. You know, if they are looking for what they think is Jungian material in there, they don't find much of it.
That's probably a good challenge for them. But I wanted to pick up.
Oh, it most certainly is. Yeah.
Pick up a little on what you were talking about before the break. You were saying that there is this prophetic strand.
Oh, yeah.
In the book, and I'd love to hear you say just a little bit about what you find most valuable in that strand, in terms of where we are today, in terms of this
yes.
moment when
well,
the book finally arrives.
The entire body of prophetic material in the Red Book is based really on one sort of major proposition, and that is that the age of human history, which played out over the two past millennia and a little more, is drawing to a close. And that another period is starting, and this is roughly correlated with the old astrological idea of the precession of the equinoxes, and that we are passing from the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius. Only Jung, gives it a lot more time. He says we're just on the well. Of course, this is almost 100 years ago that he wrote this, around that time. So now it would be less, but it would be still about 700 years before we fully entered the age of Aquarius. He also says that these astrological considerations do not cause the changes in the world consciousness, but they are merely synchronistically related to them. And then he goes on, you know, about, let's say there are various points that one can summarize. One of them is that in this new era, there will be a new religion. He uses the term religion all the time. And it will not be, a post-religious era. It will not be even a post-Christian era, because it will draw still some on the previous religious framework. But the keynote will no longer be belief, or even good works, but rather an internal transformation. So that the kind of transformation that Jung went through when writing the Red Book will be the task of all people. That will be the, you know, very important part of that new religion. And then there's a very interesting statement which most people don't relate to. If you read the book, they just kind of pass over it, where he says that the process of transformation required of the human being in this regard, in the new religion, we'll have three steps or phases, and they are, as he puts it, war, magic, and religion. He does not, of course, he wrote this during World War I, which certainly was a heck of a war, but that's not really the kind of war he's referring to, except symbolically. He means that conflict. Internal conflict. The conflict that sort of breaks down the old forms and in the psyche and all that. Then the magic is sort of a period of, just what it says, of wonder and amazement and respect for the wondrous things that one can experience primarily in the mind, and then there would come actually a religion. And when it comes to the religion, there the main emphasis seems to be on a different, and at least to us, new God concept or God image. And that God concept, which actually was there to some degree among the old Gnostics and so forth, but that God concept is the God within. So that the God is no longer worshipped out in the sky or somewhere else, although, let's say, the utter transcendence of divinity is still recognized. But in addition to that, there is an immanence in the very core of the human being. And that is where the divinity has to be recognized and addressed and probably, you know, stimulated by in various ways, and then we are, being directed and informed and redeemed by the God within. And these are sort of the primary features predictively, prophetically stated about what is going to happen in the coming aeon of Aquarius.
Were those progressive stages, Dr. Holo, like the conflict comes and then the magic and then this new way, or are they all happening at once?
Yeah. No, it looks to me, but you know, some of these things are not all that clear, but it looks to me as if they are successive steps or stages, one leading to the other.
I wanted to ask you, in the terms of that prophecy and what's to come, what do you think about the time when the book was released? Now, as they stated, there was a lot of hesitancy for this book to get released.
Oh, yeah.
And his heirs kind of put up a big to-do about even getting it put out, and it wasn't until much coaxing that, in fact, it's 2009 when the book comes out, and
yes,
as you stated, it was written, you know, so long ago. What do you think about it being released now? Do you think that's pertinent to the time we're in, and that it was, like, not released until now because
this effect? Yeah, these are, of course, again, rather tenuous issues.
Mm-hmm.
But Jung, if I'm trying to, the Christians say, what would Jesus do? What would Jung say? That's what my thing. What would Jung? I think Jung would say that certainly synchronistically, this was the right time. This is what the Greeks call the kairos. There is a right time and the wrong time for everything. And when we do something at the wrong time, it doesn't work out. If we do it at the right time, the chances of it succeeding are much, much greater. And so I think that definitely this was, and maybe still is, a kind of cut when this could take place, when it could happen. He was definitely he was interested initially in publishing right after he wrote it. And then he was advised by the few people whom he allowed to read the book, and I guess perhaps advised by his own inner self, no, you don't do this. This is not the right time to publish this.
Hmm.
And so it took this long before that became possible. And of course, outwardly, there were all kinds of external things that Dr. Shamdasani came along, who had a very good, who gained the confidence of the Jung family, basically, you know, because they owned the book. And he persuaded them that this should be done. And, that, you know, there were things of that sort that are external circumstances. But the external circumstances may have fitted into an invisible matrix, which you probably are referring to, of a synchronistic situation which was favorable for releasing this material at this time.
Well, what do you think about the times a little bit, since we're in prophecy mode? How do you think that these streams of the God within, of the sort of visionary literature tradition, how do they speak to this Kairos moment that we're in? How do they feed into our current conundrum?
Well, I would think that certainly many of the current conundrums, and there are many, I think would be less conundrums if some of these spiritual elements were considered and practiced perhaps by a larger number of people. So that perhaps in these predictions, and in this book, there is much that I think could help the perplexities and the difficulties and the horrors of the world. But one of the great things that I think distinguishes Jung as a predictive prophet from others of like kind is that he sees these things over very long periods of time. He never focuses on one particular year, like, you know, there are a lot of Mayan prophecies and things are going around now about next year, about year 12 and so forth. No, he never takes that kind of short-term view, but he deals in vast movements of psycho-spiritual development. And that, I think, is really much more helpful and ultimately perhaps also much more likely to be true and to be to come to pass. If we expect these developments to make some kind of a big immediate difference, or I don't know, politically, economically, socially, whatever, I think then we are, as my Kabbalistic joke has it, we are barking up the wrong tree of life. But thank you for laughing. But you know, if we can take that wider view, then I think we have something very valuable here. And of course, for those who were interested in Jung all along, and for, you know, students of Jung, this is really the Red Book is sort of the key to a vast amount of material in his subsequent writings. And I did already some work with that in lectures and so forth. The alchemical writings have been purely inspired by the Red Book, because he wanted to get the Red Book message out somehow in a different way, and he found a modality for doing that in alchemy. Mm. The transformation and so forth, and many of the other books. And then, of course, toward the end of his life, when he wrote three books, Mysterium Conjunctionis, Ion, and Answer to Job, those are sort of, At that point, as the result of, I can't go into all of that, but he had a series of other visions when he was very sick in 1944. And they encouraged him to be a little more open about this material. And that came out in those three books. And they, particularly Ion and Answer to Job, are very, very prophetic in terms of foretelling possible developments in the future. I think that no doubt this is there's something important has come to the culture in the Red Book. Now the issue is to deal with it, to assimilate it, and to interpret it in an insightful fashion.
And all those lectures that you gave, those are, for folks that are listening, those are all available on your website, right?
They are all available. We have a quite extensive Gnostic website, www.gnosis.org, which has many, many things in it, archival material. But when you look for lectures there, you find it. We always have at least a couple of lectures that people can listen to on the Internet free. There are others that can be purchased. And of course, every Friday when I am in town, which nowadays is most of the time, a little after 8 o'clock, I lecture at 3363 Glendale Boulevard, which is in the Atwater District in LA, right between Glendale and Los Feliz District. Very nice. We have very nice facilities. We have a nice parking lot. Everything is very very fine place to come to, and we have been there now for about 6 years, and everybody has always been very happy and very safe. So, you know, their people can also get some more of this material, because I never really veer too far away from Jung at this point, yeah. Just because of the Red Book publication in my lectures.
It's wonderful. For those of folks in L.A., you should make it out there. And they're still only $5 each, is that correct? On Fridays?
Excuse me?
On Fridays, the lectures, they're $5.
We don't charge. We don't have any fixed charge at all.
Oh, just donation.
So it's a completely free will situation. But of course, if people are too poor in this bad economy to give anything, then don't worry about it. If you have more than $5, then that will be very welcome too.
You know, I wanted to ask you one question, even though we only have a few minutes
right.
Left. One thing that I've always been interested in your work is that there are a lot of spiritual people and scholars who are very interested in the traditions associated with Gnosticism and Hermeticism and
yes.
and the currents that run through even the Catholic Church. And there's a certain kind of traditionalism that's very attractive for people who are into this kind of material. And some of them wind up with very conservative worldviews in the sense of politically, that in the old days there was a hierarchy, and now with democracy, it's a big mess. One of the things about you, your work that I picked up on, and I know you even wrote a book about it, is you really emphasize the liberty part of spiritual liberty. That in some ways, maybe partly because of your experience growing up in Hungary under the Soviets, but you're more of a Gnostic libertarian than a Gnostic traditionalist in that sense.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I have my little book, Freedom, written some years ago, which actually is selling better now than it did when it was published, where people can inform themselves about that. Yes, I think if I were asked, I would say that I am a spiritual or a Gnostic libertarian. And those people whom you are referring to, there is a kind of neo-traditionalist current. Doesn't really make too much difference where it comes from, but it kind of started with the Frenchman René Guénon and various others, and they are the ones who sort of idealize and romanticize the Middle Ages and earlier periods, which certainly had a few features that were maybe preferable to our present condition, but a heck of a lot of others that were way lot worse. Every historical period and every spiritual period, too, has its shadow. Anything that walks in the sun casts a shadow. And so it will not do to idealize some things in the past and then do nothing but cast aspersions on the present. We are in the present. We have to work with the situation in the present. And I think books like Jung's Red Book point to the present. Here, something is happening. The changes are beginning already. We are moving into a new aeon, and there will be certain important features. Let's work on this and not worry too much as to, what may or may not have happened in the past. That's all right. The past is past. It's still important. We can learn from it, but still it's past.
Yeah, it also seems like it's a way for people, it's a way for the Gnostic experience, the Gnostic current, to intermingle with other perhaps more secular drives that are happening now, because there's a way in which the question of what liberty is and the question of what freedom is such a powerful one now, and it's also being changed, because some of the old ideas we had about what freedom are, we can see now, are a little bit, they too are caught up in the past, and that something is happening even with that category, even in just a political secular sense. And there's something about that Gnostic current that can help inflect that.
These things are, these decisions have to be made by the individual. So I would say that if a sufficient number of individuals have a measure of gnosis, of that liberating vision, that liberating knowledge in their psyche, then they will be able to relate themselves creatively to the developments, political and historical and economic and sociological, and that are going on in the world, and will be probably able to do some good. But I like a statement that unfortunately doesn't come from Jung, but from the late Mr. Krishnamurti, who said the world problem is the individual problem. And I think that Jung would agree with that.
All right, well, we're going to have to stop right there.
Right.
Thank you so much, Dr. Holler. It was a wonderful conversation.
Okay. Thank you so very much, and thank you, and thank the Lady Maja for having put up with me, and I hope that maybe we'll, at least with you, Mr. Davis, that we'll meet in person.
Wonderful.
All right. All the best to you.
Okay.
Thank you.
From me and Maja at Expanding Mind, keep your minds open.